Welcome to The Signal. I'm Aaron Henkin. The Maryland Film Festival kicks off next week. It runs May 7th through the 11th at a variety of theaters here in Baltimore. And today on the radio program, we're going to take some time to delve into the upcoming offerings and get a sense of what we can look forward to on the silver screen. Joining us, as he often does for these cinematic explorations, is Signal film critic Josh Slates. And Josh, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me. This is always a lot of fun.
Coming up, we're going to speak with John Waters. We're going to be speaking with horror film director Chris LaMartina. We're going to be talking about some short films. We're going to be talking about a special revival film. But first, Josh, talk to us about the layout of the film festival this year. A little bit different. No Charles Theater, number one, but some new venues to see these movies.
Yeah, it's going to be a period of adjustment. Most of the screenings are going to be centered around the Micah Brown Center, the University of Baltimore. The Windup Space will be returning once again as a screening venue. The Tent Village, with all of the panels and the speakers, that's going to be on the 100 block of North Avenue. And they are actually adding the Walters Art Museum as a screening venue, which, if you've never seen a movie at the Walters, it's a pretty snazzy place to see a movie.
That said, we're going to move now to a conversation with a man who has been an annual guest at the Maryland Film Festival since the festival's inception in 1999. He's been there every year to curate and introduce a film of his own choosing to share with the festival attendees. And we can say that his choices are always unpredictable and cringeworthy often. Ladies and gentlemen, we're happy to welcome to the program John Waters. John, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me here.
So, John, for the past few years, you've unveiled your annual Maryland Film Festival selection right here on The Signal. Before you go ahead and announce this year's choice, allow me to build the suspense here. I'm going to play the opening minute of this mystery film. It's in French, by the way. The film opens up. We see a woman lying on her bed under white sheets. She's just woken up. She looks alarmed. She's feeling her own arm. She looks confused. She sits up unsteadily, tries to stand, collapses to the floor, drags herself to the phone, calls 911, and she says, "I think I'm half dead." John Waters, who is this woman? What's happened to her? What's this movie all about?
Well, it's the great French actress Isabelle Huppert, who is playing the great French director Catherine Breillat, who both are extreme. You know, if I pick the movie, it's a great French feel-bad movie that is exciting, funny, horrible. And this one is really crazy because it's based on kind of the true story of the director who did have a brain aneurysm. And then she tried to make a movie, and she fell in love with a criminal stud she read about in the newspaper and wanted to put him in the movie. And she falls passionately, obsessively in love with him, and he will never have sex with her, and he gets every penny that she ever made in her whole life. It's a love story of sorts.
The title of the film, by the way, Abuse of Weakness. I mean, that title just screams a John Waters favorite.
It does. It sounds like kind of, you know, the kind of movie that I would run to. I'd be the first in line alone on the matinee and be the only person in the theater. But I'm amazed. Every year at the festival, the audience is so great that comes to see my movie. And these are not easy movies. These are not movies. I hate feel-good movies. I like feel-bad movies because I feel good in real life anyway.
Well, there's a great quote from the director, Catherine Breillat. She said, "There's a lot of hatred toward me in France. If everyone who criticized me had actually bought a ticket to see my films, I'd be rich."
Yeah, I met her once, and she's a piece of work in a great way, even visually. And she, you know, like all French people, you know, she usually can't speak English, but what can I say? I can't speak French. But she did know my films, and she was a fan of my films. And I'm only sorry we couldn't get her to come over because I think her health, it's still an issue.
Yeah, she's suffering from hemiplegia. The left side of her body is paralyzed. But, you know, none of her mordant sense of humor or, you know, filmmaking abilities have been compromised as
well. In this movie, Isabelle Huppert has a really stunningly chic pair of orthopedic Oxfords that she keeps falling down in, that are my favorite scenes when she falls down repeatedly in the movie.
Well, as a matter
it's
of fact,
entertainment. You'll
Catherine
be so happy.
Breillat,
she wears them.
Well, she gets a credit as a costume designer because she had Isabelle Huppert wear all of her own personal clothing and effects for the film.
Well, Isabelle I've met too, and she's look at the movies she picks. I mean, from The Pianist, she picks every movie she picks is insane usually. But in real life, and she's, I think, incredibly beautiful in movies, in real life, she almost is, you wouldn't notice her walking down the street. I mean, she, until she has a part. And so these two together are like my kind of women.
Let's get back to the crux of this film. It's an autobiographical film made by this director who, for however controversial she's been throughout her life, has suffered this cerebral hemorrhage. It's left her partly paralyzed, and then she found herself duped by this con man.
No, was she duped? Some people like that. Some people like unobtainable. Some people, maybe they had a really hot relationship because they never had sex and always wanted to. Think of that. That doesn't happen to most couples.
And she fell in love with him, in a sense, after knowing his cards were on the table. He had already been in jail for being a con man.
Yeah.
He was on TV sort of talking about, he was actually sort of like promoting a book he'd written about, you know, having been an imprisoned con man. And she saw that and she thought, oh, I'd like to get to know this guy.
I'd like to date him.
Right? And so, I don't know. I mean, I guess it's...
Everyone has strange relationships. And I always am interested in strange relationships and try to understand them and try to put yourself in the position of that. He told her right in the beginning, I'm never going to sleep with you. Well, that's a challenge if you're a film director and you're casting somebody. I personally have almost never slept with anybody in my films. I think it's a really bad idea to do that because then you can't tell them what to do.
In a sense, what this director has done, Briat, who has been so controversial, pushed so many buttons, is maybe made herself a little more humanized to her audience by showing her vulnerability.
Maybe, but most people, if they went through this, wouldn't want people to know it. Yeah. They would hardly make a movie about it. If you thought about your life and like, what's the most screwed up thing I ever did, and then make a movie about it? Because at the end, her family said, wait a minute, you blew all the money from the family? Like everything. She gave him every penny. And she said, I didn't. I really have no idea why I did that. But yes, I did. And you think, oh my God, this could happen to anybody. I mean, you never know. Love is strange.
It's cringeworthy. It's awkward. It's everything you would expect in a John Waters Maryland Film Festival film selection. The title again, Abuse of Weakness, by director Catherine Briat. John Waters, always a pleasure having you on the airwaves with
Thank
us.
You.
Thanks for being here.
Thanks, John.
You're tuned to WYPR. I'm Aaron Henkin here with Signal film critic Josh Slates. And joining us now by phone is director Michael Tully. His film Ping Pong Summer is going to be part of the festival. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. Very happy to be on.
So, Michael, this film, Ping Pong Summer, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like the kind of film that like a filmmaking grown-up would make if he were handed the script by like the 13-year-old version of himself. Is that a fair assessment?
That's it. We're done here. You just summed it up. It's over. The interview is over. We have nothing else to say. That's exactly what happened. No, really, Ping Pong Summer, it's a movie. I grew up in Maryland. I was in PG County in Bowie till I was 8. And then in 1982, my family moved to Mount Airy, Maryland. And I started writing it as a senior in high school. And at that point, you know, a period piece. It was definitely set in the 80s then. And it was sort of a period piece, but not really as long as it took for my slow gestating self to actually make the movie in 2014. Now it's really a period piece. And now apparently the 80s are cool, but just for the record, you know, personally, it was born out of my desire to sort of fuse the movies that I grew up on watching in the 80s. I would love to say I was a big Frederick Wiseman, Bellatar viewer in the 80s, but I was just going to the local video store, going to Errol's and renting like National Lampoon's Vacation and watching it 30 times a weekend on VHS. So what I tried to do was insert my own very normal middle-class upbringing, going to Ocean City, Maryland, which was a fantasia for me, into an 80s movie. And, it was, you know, that was the goal, was to see what would happen with that experiment.
Well, it's a beautiful homage to those quintessential teen comedies in the 1980s, all the way down to your protagonist's red parachute pants, this character Rad. Tell us who this young hero is and just sort of the challenges he faces in this film.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's a sort of generic, you could say, just insert a person into the Karate Kid scenario of kid in a new town. But for me, what was interesting was to try to insert you know, like, it's not like a Napoleon Dynamite where the kid is goofy and he's a character. What was really important to me was to insert a shy 13-year-old that you kind of knew was going to be cool one day and sort of find his groove eventually, but he was just too young and it hadn't happened yet. So I wanted it to be right on that precipice between 8th and 9th grade when you're like, I know I'm cool, but everything you do is kind of not cool. And even the fact that he was wearing red parachute pants was just like a year or two too soon. So it was really important to set the movie in that period. And I wanted Rad to just be a kind of every kid that we all feel like we were maybe at one point, and we knew we had it in us, but the time hadn't come yet.
Josh Slates, I want to bring you into this conversation here with filmmaker Michael Tully. You actually participated in the making of this movie.
Yeah, I was honored to serve as the location manager for Ping Pong Summer and to help fulfill Michael Tully's vision of an untouched 1985 Ocean City, you know, a bygone but perhaps no less innocent era of Ocean City.
And all you know, humility aside or whatever, Josh was incredible. And for the record, I would personally say that, like, first AD and locations manager are the hardest jobs on a film production set. So Josh took many for the team, I would say. That's the job of the location manager, and kept me very conveniently away from these sort of nightmare scenarios that were happening and the nightmares the following day that could have been happening and then somehow got worked out because of Josh.
Thank you, Josh.
Thank you, Michael.
Let me ask you guys both this question. You spent an extended period of time in Ocean City, Maryland, like way longer than the average vacation lasts in Ocean City, Maryland. What's it like to live there for weeks and weeks on end? How long were you guys down there?
Well, I was there for 9 weeks in Ocean City in the off season, which meant as the restaurants began to shutter for the season, your dining options became much more limited and eventually pared down to fried dough, ice cream, and, you know, the dough roller, I think. I felt a lot of responsibility working on the movie because a lot of the locations in the movie are the actual Ocean City locations. It's not like you can find another
Paul Revere's smorgasbord.
Yeah, there's no compromising on, you know, some of the locations in the film. So I felt like a tremendous amount of responsibility to deliver and also try to feel like everyone in Ocean City had a share in making sure that this turned into like a really cool, memorable movie for the ages and something that, you know, everyone could get behind. So
you talk about a lot of on-site locations. One of the main locations, though, was something of your own creation. It was an interior shot of a place called the Fun Hub. And Josh Slates, yep. I want you to set up this clip that we're going to play from a scene in the Fun Hub.
Yeah, the Fun Hub in the imagination of Michael Tully's Ocean City is a ping pong video game arcade battleground where Rad Miracle, must do battle with local bullies Lyle and Dale to win the heart of his Ocean City crush, Stacy Summers, played by Emmy Shockley.
Right, so here's Rad Miracle, great name for a hero, by the way, playing ping pong with his buddy. In walk these two bullies, and bully number one goes over and starts strong-arming his girlfriend.
Where have you been?
Where you're not.
What's your problem?
Get off me, perv.
Not until you tell me what your problem is.
I don't have a problem.
Yes, you do.
Step off her!
Step off her? I can step on her whenever I want. Bro.
A scene of no small dramatic tension there from the film Ping Pong Summer by Michael Tully. Michael Tully is joining us on the phone. And Michael, I want you to talk about the time frame when you shot this film on location in Ocean City. Here it is, this nostalgic sort of imaginary look back to an Ocean City that was. And then ironically, it kind of became the document of an Ocean City that was.
Well, fortunately, it didn't become the document that it could have become based on the scenario. We wrapped the movie at 2 a.m. on Saturday night. It was basically a Friday night shoot, but we wrapped at 2 a.m. with our 16-millimeter camera literally strapped to the pier, the Ocean City Pier. The final shot was a shot from above of the kids below, so we had the camera strapped to the pier. And then, so that's 2 a.m. We had a little champagne toast, lots of hugs and happiness. 9 a.m. Monday morning, the pier was gone because Hurricane Sandy hit. So as I was driving away from Ocean City Sunday morning to escape back to Austin, Texas, and I put David Wingo's Take Shelter soundtrack on and was looking through the rearview mirror at the sky, I thought we were going to be making not just a time capsule of 1980s Ocean City, but a time capsule of 2012 Ocean City. And fortunately, mercifully, the damage was, in context, very minimal, especially compared to New Jersey. So the pier, and then I think another institution, something out on the bay, was demolished, dismantled. But otherwise, it was just flooding. So Ocean City got really, really lucky.
Well, it's a beautiful film, Michael Tully. Congratulations on it. We'll look forward to its arrival here at the 2014 Maryland Film Festival. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you guys so much. See y'all soon at the fest.
Thank you, sir.
Michael Tully, director of Ping Pong Summer. You're tuned to The Signal on 88.1 WIPR. Aaron Henkin here in studio with Signal film critic Josh Slates. And Josh, we're happy to welcome now to the studio a local horror movie maven made good, a man who has directed 7 feature-length horror films, the latest of which is Call Girl of Cthulhu, Chris LaMartina. Welcome to the program. Good to have you with us.
It's good to be back, guys. Thank you so much.
First, if you'd be so kind, a thumbnail synopsis of the goings-on in Call Girl of Cthulhu.
Sure. So basically, this is a horror film inspired by the works of weird fiction author H.P. Lovecraft. It's about a virginal artist who falls in love with an escort who is destined to be the bride of an alien god, the god Cthulhu. And she's slated to end humanity, and he's got to save her and save humanity.
I really want to give listeners an opportunity to experience this movie as best they can, at least over radio, because it does sound almost as gross as it looks. Let's go ahead and listen to a clip of this film, Call Girl of Cthulhu.
Cosmos has summoned you, Riley.
Yeah, Cthulhu!
You must answer the call.
Let me say those are very visceral sound effects, very convincing. And Chris LaMartina, as a horror movie director, obviously your visuals are important, but things have to sound scary too, right?
Absolutely. And obviously, radio listeners right now will hear those gross sounds and probably will imagine something way more horrifying than anything I could capture as a visual storyteller. But we made sure every, you know, squirt of gore, every slither of a tentacle was taken very seriously in regard to audio production.
Chris, I want to have you talk a little bit about the particular sort of vintage of your gore. You're not like a really into computer special effects. You're sort of, there's like a Traumaville vintage to your gore where it's done actually by like lots of fake blood and fake prosthetics and stuff like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are some visual effects in Call Girl, but most of the visual effects are for things like laser zaps and like portal and warp, things like that. The practical effects were very important for us. We worked with Aftermath Effects, who made the effects for the film. And you mentioned Troma. Troma actually used them for their last feature, Return to Class at Newcomb High. They did the effects for that as well.
Traumaville, of course, is probably most famous for the Toxic Avenger series.
Yeah, Toxic Avenger, right. Romeo and Juliet, Class at Newcomb High, all those flicks.
Of course, one of the other essential ingredients of horror movies of this particular early 80s vintage is no small dose of nudity. And your film follows in suit. I should say, though, your leading lady is also someone that you are personally involved with. This is your fiance. You're putting up there in very little clothing.
That is correct. We weren't dating when we were when she was cast and we were producing the film. I fell in love with her during production. This is a very candid personal story. Before people call me a sleaze, I'm going to say this. I always thought it was total garbage when somebody says you find the person you spend the rest of your life with, until I met Melissa O'Brien, and then I realized this is the most perfect woman for me. So that's the sentimental value to talking about nudity in my film. But so basically, let's talk about nudity in the film, because a couple years ago when we were making movies, we didn't put any nudity. We didn't have excessive gore in our films. We loved movies that had over-the-top special effects, and I don't mind nudity in films, but we didn't see the intrinsic value in it except for marketing. And we learned very quickly that helped us get exposure, these two elements.
So to speak.
Yeah, exactly, right? And as we started putting these elements in the film, our distribution offers like quadrupled and we got a wider net for the films we were making. But as this happened, I also wanted to make sure that we did these things not just for the sake of doing it for marketing. And we're making a film called Call Girl of Cthulhu. A film about sex work will obviously have to have nudity in it. And when we talk about the demographic for people who are watching horror films, most of these guys are adolescent males. And if you think about it this way, we're making a movie that really deals with adolescent male fears of female sexuality. So, you know,
they have reason to be threatened by it after having seen this film, I should say.
Well, I mean, hopefully it addresses it in a healthy way, that these are fears that are, you know, you get these fictional fears that deal with these very silly real world fears that these gentlemen have.
What an interesting reality, though, that you have to look at what is a viable business option for you, too, as a horror movie producer. I mean, these films are sort of more commoditized, it seems, than other art films.
The horror film market and the film market in general is oversaturated with content. It's really hard to stick out above the fray when there's a dozen horror flicks popping up every day on VOD or on cable. And you had to have a really strong high concept and pretty much a built-in marketing structure. When we were starting to come up with the idea for this film, I was seeing Cthulhu memes on Facebook and social media all the time. And I had been a fan of Lovecraft when I was a kid. I mean, like, ironically, I knew what it meant for something to be Lovecraftian before I knew who H.P. Lovecraft was. Like, that's how he had broken into the cultural zeitgeist, so to speak. We knew that that was a huge fan base, and it was a fan base that spoke to what we loved as horror fans, like crazy monster movies. Building off that, we knew we could make a film that would catch a wider audience, and that's what was really important to us.
Signal film critic Josh Lates, I notice you've been sitting there conspicuously quiet. As an erudite film critic, any questions for our horror movie maker?
No, I've been watching Chris's movies for years, and I've been watching how his movies have been sort of evolving and growing in scale. But what I love is to tune in and see the familiar faces. You know, in the new movie, you've got returning favorites like George Stover, Nikki LaFay, Ruby LaRocca. It's almost like a family reunion, or like a really, you know, twisted, you know, high school reunion. I'm not sure which, but it's always a treat to see his latest and greatest, and Call Girl of Cthulhu will not disappoint.
Yeah, it's really important for me to keep that family mentality on my sets. I always joke like it's like summer camps, you know, going making movies is like being in summer camp, and the teams that we've assembled mean a lot to me. They are family, and if I could work with them over and over again, I will, and usually I do.
Horror movie director Chris LaMartina, most recently of Call Girl of Cthulhu, which is going to be screening here at the 2014 Maryland Film Fest. Chris, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much, guys.
From WIPR in Baltimore, this is The Signal. I'm Aaron Henkin. Our program this week, look ahead at the 2014 Maryland Film Festival with Signal film critic Josh Slates. Lots more movies to talk about right after the break. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Signal. I'm Aaron Henkin, and I'm joined this week in studio by Signal film critic Josh Slates. Josh, once again, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, as always.
Josh and I are taking a look ahead here at the 2014 Maryland Film Festival. And joining us now by phone is Joe Swanberg, the filmmaker behind the new feature, Happy Christmas. Joe, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Happy Christmas. I don't know much about this film other than that your son... Your baby son steals the show, I hear.
Yeah, Jude was two when we made the movie and sort of beautifully unaware of the fact that he was acting in a movie. So you're just getting unadulterated, amazing two-year-old. And yeah, it turns out that's pretty fascinating to watch when sort of put up against veteran actors.
So, well, aside from your two-year-old scene stealer, tell us about this film. Tell us what it's about, who's in it, and what's the story behind it.
Sure. Well, Anna Kendrick stars in the movie, and she plays my little sister. Melanie Linsky and I play a young couple in Chicago with a two-year-old son, and we've just bought a house, and I play a filmmaker in the movie. She plays a novelist. And we're sort of just getting our creative and family life sorted out. And Anna Kendrick plays my little sister who's gone through a breakup and decides she needs a change in her life. And we invite her to come to Chicago and live in our basement, thinking that she can help out with the baby and ease some of the new stress in our lives. And instead, we discover that she is sort of much more immature, reckless, house guest than we bargained for, and we kind of end up raising two kids rather than one.
This is a complex contemporary family drama. But I have to say, you know, you've joined our program before as a director, as an actor. It seems like you switch very fluidly between the two.
Well, I sort of accidentally happened into an acting career. I started acting in some of my own films, and then friends of mine started casting me in things. So in the last few years, I did as much acting as I did directing, which was unexpected but kind of nice. I mean, and so I still show up in my own films occasionally, but I'm kind of satisfying the acting bug these days in other people's movies.
Now, after all of these years, you've become almost an annual fixture here at the festival, and I'd love for you to take a moment and tell us what keeps bringing you back. Is it the audiences, the sense of community, the films? What do you enjoy most?
The Maryland Film Festival sort of became a kind of gathering point for a certain segment of the indie film community, and because of the structure of the festival, you know, it takes place over a weekend. And there's just, you know, the festival organizers have done such a good job making it a good environment for ideas to sort of flow and for everybody to connect with each other. So, you know, it's not just me. I feel like every alumni of the festival tries to make it a point to come back every year because it's just such a good breeding ground for new ideas and new talent. And, you know, a lot of the people that I feel like I've ended up working with were people who I initially met in Baltimore. So in addition to the great films and great programming, that's made it even more of a valuable resource for the indie film community.
Joe Swanberg, actor, director, a perennial favorite at the Maryland Film Festival. His latest film is Happy Christmas. And Joe, thanks for taking the time to join us.
Yeah, my pleasure. And I'll see you guys at the festival.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks, man.
You're tuned to The Signal. I'm Aaron Henkin here with Signal film critic Josh Slates. And joining us now by phone is Sophia Takal. Sophia, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks.
Sophia, tell us about this film, your latest film with your filmmaking other half, Lawrence Michael Levine. The film is called Wild Canaries.
Yeah, it's a comedy murder mystery about a couple that suspects foul play when one of their neighbors turns up dead. I acted in it and produced it, and Lawrence, who's my real-life husband, directed it and also acted in it.
So together you've made this murder mystery, but essentially it's a comedy of human frailty and human folly. I mean, and just all of our sort of warts as human beings are exposed as we watch you as our surrogates trying to solve this mystery, but just, you know, sort of being complicated, flawed people at the same time.
Yeah, we're really attracted to films that are about relationships and have, you know, are very naturalistic, but at the same time, some of our favorite movies are these old screwball comedies, like the Thin Man series, which is about a bickering couple that solves murder mysteries, or, you know, What's Up, Doc, which is something that Lawrence often references as a big inspiration for him. He's like movies with strong kind of Daffy dames and the men who follow them around and get sucked into their vortex. So we kind of were really interested in combining those two elements, you know, the more screwball and genre aspects of the film, including enough of that to give us a little bit of time to delve into these relationship problems.
What I thought was really fun about the movie was, you know, you mentioned the influence of The Thin Man. I thought it was sort of like a Elaine May by way of Dashiell Hammett, sort of modern day New York City screwball murder mystery. And it's just like a really fun movie. And I think it shines through in, you know, the fact that you guys look like you had a lot of fun making it, too.
Yeah, it was the biggest movie we've made, you know, crew size and budget size. So there were new challenges that we weren't used to facing. But it was very, very fun, and everyone on set was really great to work with. And we'd been traveling on the festival circuit a lot, and we'd been working on movies, and we realized that the movies that we were most excited about seeing were these old films that were really fun to watch in bed together, like ordering Chinese takeout and just watching and sort of talking through and having fun and cuddling up. And we kind of wanted to just make a movie to honor those films that we really love watching so much and love having fun.
Well, Sophia Takal, it's been nice to have you with us here on the program. Thanks for joining us, and we'll look forward to your new film, Wild Canaries.
Thanks.
All right, take care.
Thank you so much.
You're tuned to The Signal on WIPR. I'm Aaron Henkin here in studio with Signal film critic Josh Slates. And Josh, there is a revival screening at the festival that you're very excited about, a movie called Liquid Sky. What is this movie all about?
Well, it's a classic of early 1980s New York underground cinema. It's directed by a Russian director named Slava Sukerman, starring Anne Carlyle as two equally androgynous male and female supermodels, Margaret and Jimmy. And it's about their rivalry in the New York fashion world while they're battling an alien invasion that arrives in the most unlikely of forms, I guess you could say. And the whole movie is fueled by this really insane synthesizer score performed on the New York City public access synthesizer studio.
Which who system. Knew there was such a thing as a public access synthesizer in New York City?
Well, it was used to great effect with the soundtrack, which is just sort of a classic of electronic scores performed on a public access New York City synthesizer system.
Back to this movie, Josh. This film, I put it into my DVD, the screener that you lent me, and I thought, is there something wrong with my DVD player? Because the colors are so saturated, and I mean, it's almost like one of those special effects you can put on your movie with iMovie, just to make it look crazy. But this is obviously before a lot of that digital technology was even available.
Well, what's really kind of wonderful about the movie is that it's a science fiction film, and it has its, you know, sort of genre trappings, but it borrows a lot of visual imagery and sort of production methods from really like avant-garde animated films of the 1960s and 70s. So it's this strange collision of hyper-visual art movie and sort of a commentary on vanity and heroin addiction in a New York City that doesn't really exist anymore. So it's also this curious document of just a completely bygone era.
And the heroine, as in female hero of this movie, Margaret, she's a complicated character.
Well, in one of the best scenes in the movie, there's a really memorable monologue that the lead actress, Anne Carlyle, delivers. She was actually one of the co-screenwriters of the movie, where she talks about, you know, her dream of coming to New York City in sort of a American Cinderella fable. And this is sort of Slava Sukerman's depiction of the American dream in crisis and how that manifested itself in the fashion modeling scene of the early 1980s in New York City. It's just such a bizarre movie. I highly recommend it.
Let's go ahead and play this clip. This is from near the end of the film, and this is our character, Margaret.
I was taught that my prince would come, and he would be a lawyer, and I would have his children. And on the weekends, we would barbecue. And all the other princes and their princesses would come. And they would say, delicious, delicious. Oh, how boring.
Actress Anne Carlyle in the film Liquid Sky delivering, I guess, what would have been her Oscar clip if this movie had been anything other than a completely obscure 1980s art film. Liquid Sky, Josh, I know you're excited about this screening because the film has never been available on home video.
Well, it's been out of print for over 14 years, and it hasn't really been seen in theaters since it premiered in 1982. So the idea that the director of the movie is coming to the Maryland Film Festival with his personal 35mm print and the fact that he's hosting the screening, I'm hoping perhaps finally, you know, some of our questions he might be able to answer after all these years.
Signal film critic Josh Slates, you've outdone yourself once again. A thorough preview of the 2014 Maryland Film Festival. I can tell listeners that more information is online at md-filmfest.com. That said, Josh Slates, thank you as always.
This is always really, really cool. Thank you for having me.